Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Thank you, Emma. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available as a podcast, obviously, and it's also available on iTunes. We're going to dip into the archives in just a little bit. We're going to replay my epic chat with John Krull, the host of No Limits. The show is going away after 9 years, and we're going to replay in its entirety for the first time our breakdown of all of the films of Elvis Presley. We'll get to that in a little bit, but first, there's a segment of the show that we do called Dead People We Like, because we don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like, but I'm not going to play that clip because I just want to raise a glass to Eva Kaur, of course, the subject of the documentary Eva that we here at WFYI produced, and a powerful woman and a powerful story of survival and forgiveness. So, Eva, thank you. Thank you for being, for your contribution to this planet. And it's, if you've looked for the film, you'll find it, but it's... Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm stammering a little bit. So I'm trying to start the show on a serious note before we go into the rest of the stuff. So salute, Eva. One of the films I was supposed to talk about this week got pushed back to next week. So I guess we're doing some catching up for a little bit. I did finally see Midsommar, the new film from Ari Aster, who, of course, the follow-up to the great film from last year, Hereditary. And Florence Pugh is the star of this, and it's a group of American 20-somethings who go to a commune in northern Sweden for a festival. And of course, as the cliches goes, nothing is what it seems. If you've seen Hereditary... what this filmmaker is capable of doing, and it happens in both of these films, is capturing an amazing sense of dread. This is not your scary movies from the 70s and 80s. It's a little more than that. I think Midsommar is a step down from Hereditary, even though I understood it more. I loved Hereditary, and I thought Toni Collette was great, and there were still a couple of moments I wasn't quite 100%, and yeah, I had to look it up. But what Midsommar does, and most of it looks great. It's shot most of it in daylight and a lot of white outfits and the beauty of nature as the film goes on, especially into the second half, where this is more than just a commune. It pokes at what is the difference between commune and cult, tradition and madness. One could say it pokes at organized religion, but I think your own backgrounds will come into what you get out of this film. The Florence Pugh character, who has suffered a tragedy at the very, very beginning, and unbeknownst to her, was almost going to be dumped on by her grad school boyfriend, who winds up taking her on this trip. She was not supposed to go, and winds up tagging along. The film has a subgenre of film homage that... it plays on, And that's the dead teenager movie, the kind of the slasher movies of the 70s and 80s, where you have a group of kids and you're just kind of waiting for them to get picked off one by one. The other half, obviously, if you've seen the trailers, the film owes a great debt to the original The Wicker Man. Or if you've not seen that, the second half of Hot Fuzz. So it clocks in at 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it takes its time. It does not, even when blood starts to spill, it does not speed up and turn into a slasher movie from the 70s and 80s, even in the last. And I think there's probably a part of me that wish it sped up a little bit, but not to the degree of a slasher movie from that era, from what stuff I grew up with. It's not a perfect film. I liked it, even though it's a step down from Hereditary, and we take a lot of build up for a final moment that comes off as a dark joke, even though you see it coming miles and miles away. So, but I'll take a flawed experiment of something like this than the stuff I had to grow up watching on video at home. So anyway, it's not for everybody. And there's some really jarring moments in this that also helps balance it out. If one can wince while watching some imagery in this, and there's some uncomfortable visuals in this film of not just of violence, but of ritual. So anyway, it's out there, and I think I'm slightly in the middle on this, although it's been a love-hate film, as was Hereditary. So anyway, that is out there. Now, of course, this weekend, while we're shifting gears, if at midnight at the Keystone Arts Cinema is The Room this Friday and Saturday evening. I will be there for both shows, so hope to see you there. Three interesting titles on Blu-ray, old titles, and I have to admit I had never seen this, and it's amazing what happens that what you watch when it's sent to you. But the 1989 miniseries Lonesome Dove is now out on Mill Creek, and it's a nice packaging. But and I'm surprised I hadn't seen this, because this is now a Western staple. At the time this came out in the late 80s, the Western genre was dead, with the exceptions of, in the cinema, of Silverado from Lawrence Kasdan, and before that, Clint Eastwood's attempt of Shane called Pale Rider. And this is 3 years before Eastwood's masterpiece Unforgiven. But it's based on the novel of Larry McCurtry, the man who gave us The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment. And it's the story of some retired Texas Rangers, played by Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones, as well as Robert Urich, who go on a cattle drive from Texas to Montana. And it's four episodes, hour and a half. So six. It's a six-hour miniseries. And thank God it's a miniseries. Apparently, this was originally supposed to be a film for John Wayne, Henry Fonda, and Jimmy Stewart in the 70s, and it didn't happen. And I think we're all the better for it, because because of the 6 hours, we get to spend time with these characters. And Duvall is great. And apparently, Duvall has said this is his favorite performance of his career, and it shows, because he's able to take the grizzled old cowhand and add a little spark to it, add a little life, add a little humor. He's got some wonderful chemistry with everybody he crosses his path with, especially Angelica Houston as the past love of his life, and the town whore played by Diane Lane. Tommy Lee Jones, a little young to play the role, but, you know, he grew a beard and was and this was at the beginning of his kind of grizzled old coot phase that he is in now. But Angelica Houston, as I mentioned, Danny Glover, Robert Urich, who's really good, Ricky Schroeder, who I think dropped the Y while making this film, apparently I believe turned 18 on this, and it's a perfect role for him to make the transition from Silver Spoons and all the kid stuff to this as kind of an 18-year-old ranch hand. I think I wrote in my notes, if this was a John Wayne film, he would have been played by one of Wayne's kids or a pop singer from the 60s. D.B. Sweeney, then unknown Chris Cooper, then unknown Steve Buscemi. Glenn Headley is involved in this. Really good acting across the board. It's directed by Simon Windsor, who an Australian, yes, doing an American Western, who would later do films like Quigley Down Under, Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man. Nothing cinematically comes close to this. We hadn't had an epic Western like this since probably How the West Was Won in the 1960s, and that was spotty at best. Oh, Frederick Forrest is also in this. Another sign of the times, you have Frederick Forrest playing an Indian who has a grudge against Duvall's character. You also get to see these grizzled cowboy characters show emotions, especially from the likes of Duvall and Jones and Chris Cooper, who he had only done, I think, of note, Matewan at this time. But it's a really well done tangled web of stories that that all meet together in a very, very effective way. So this is out on Blu-ray, and I'm finally glad I got to see it. Better late than never. Surprise, I hadn't. Also out on Blu-ray, Mothra. Yes, the giant from the creators of Godzilla, and I've talked before on the show about what I call the grindhouse rule, where there just certain films would just be a lot better if they were 70 minutes. And I think the Japanese monster movies should fit into that category. This one's it comes in the English language version, the dub version with the the American actors trying to do a kind of a clipped Japanese tone in their voice. Yeah, I know. It was a long time ago. But it's a 90 minutes, and the Japanese version is an hour and 40. Really, both of those are too long. But it's an island that is visited by scientists and, of course, nefarious characters who wind up kidnapping a pair of identical small twins. And this leads to Mothra attacking the world and trying to get them back. You get at least two monster attacks in this. You get the caterpillar, which happens about halfway through the film, and then about 75 minutes in, you finally get Mothra in full moth form. So that's kind of cool. But anyway, it's a good cleanup version of this film, technical wise. It was released by Columbia when it came out, I believe, 1960. So, but yeah, there's a commentary track, and like I said, both versions. So that is out there. Also out on Blu-ray, ladies and gentlemen, Picasso Trigger from 1988, another film written and directed by Andy Sedaris, who I've talked about on this show before, man known for Hard Ticket to Hawaii and Malibu Express, a film, this one filling, boasting having seven Playboy Playmates in its cast, when the spy this time is played by Steve Bond, best known for his work on General Hospital. And Donna Spear and Hope Marie Carlton are back as the not really twin blondes, but the two blonde agents who are going after an assassin who was assassinated by another assassin. Follow me. And there's a painting with his name on it, and it's his code name. And there's some twists and turns that you have no explanation whatsoever, but it does not matter because everybody is beautiful and shirts are open and there's a lot of skin and a lot of guns. And so long as there are ridiculous action scenes in this, and there are, so long as you have a few cocktails and you think very, very less about this, it can be weirdly entertaining in a kind of knuckle-dragging way. So, and yeah, Nigella Lawson said, if you feel pleasure, why feel guilty? The films of Andy Sedaris sometimes does that. And then there's a couple of other obituaries in the movie business. I do want to acknowledge Gene Pignatori, who was the coach in Hoop Dreams, died on June 26th at the age of 82. Of course, Hoop Dreams, one of the greatest documentaries, if not, and the best sports documentary ever made, about the film that follows two high school basketball proteges in Chicago. And not the most flattering look at Coach Gene, who was a longtime coach at St. Joseph High School. Basically, trying to get the job done more than nurturing, I guess. So, but the 1,035 wins, 383 losses, two state championships. And, of course, his most famous alum was Isaiah Thomas. So, but it's interesting to watch his story arc go from a chance to get out and then at times to be a roadblock for the two subjects. So, anyway, and it's a great excuse to revisit Hoop Dreams if you do. And classic that guy, Paul Benjamin, died on June 29th at the age of 81. Appeared in films like The Anderson Tapes, Across 110th Street, that's the earliest thing I, well, and Anderson Tapes that I saw him in, The Deadly Trackers, Education of Sonny Carlson, played the senator in Friday Foster, played Wes Ledbetter in the biopic Leadbelly, Some Kind of Hero, Rosewood, Nuts, Hoodlum, and The Station Agent, but the two things he's probably best known for, he played English in Clint Eastwood's film of Escape from Alcatraz, directed by Don Siegel, and the great performance as ML, one of the three corner guys, the Greek chorus in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. So, yeah, and that's where the, oh, yeah, that guy. So, Paul Benjamin, dead at the age of 81. So, thank you for your work, gang. All right, this week marks the end of the 9-year run of the new show here at WFYI called No Limits, and I'm happy to say I was a part of it. In the early stages of the film of the show, I was its board operator, and then I eventually graduated to being a regular guest. Whenever John Krull needed a film show, I was happy to jump in, along with Ed Johnson Ott and Chris Lloyd. Most of the time we recorded, although it was fun to do it live and take calls. I believe what I always remember was discussing the film 12 Years a Slave, and somebody came on, called up, and said, it's too soon to have another film about slavery. We have Roots. And I berated a caller, which, you know, you're not supposed to apparently do at NPR, and basically say that the caller is wrong. So I think that led to us doing more live, or I say more taped segments, because it would just be John and Ed and Chris and I. And we could talk about movies for hours. I also remember John Krull being the first one to say that the film Spotlight was a better journalism film than All the President's Men. And that was, at the time, huge praise. And then I finally saw the film, and he was correct. I also remember John saying the thing they especially got right in Spotlight is the wardrobe. We are reporters. We are not models. So, John, thank you for letting me be a part of your show, and I'm glad to call you a colleague and a friend. With that in mind, and we had talked about doing this for a long, long time, he is a huge Elvis fan. In fact, he did grad work on the works of Elvis Presley. So finally, after doing a show, doing one of his shows, I got him in the studio with special appearance by former intern McKenna Mays. And we decided to break down every single Elvis movie. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it went so long that I have had to, in the past, had to run it as a two-part segment because of the old programming. Now that Film Sociology is available in podcast form only, I can now, for the first time, share with you the entire epic chat with John Krull and McKenna breaking down the films of Elvis Presley. Enjoy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special edition of Film Sociology. John Krull, the host of No Limits, is here with me, as well as McKenna. And we are going to break down for you, the Film Sociology public radio listener, every film Elvis Presley ever made. So get ready, get your notebooks, find your top three. We're going to start at the very beginning. But I guess I should start with John. Where did your Elvis fandom begin?
Well, it was odd. It started when I was a small child, and I'm going to date myself here. The
producers, you didn't see Ed Sullivan.
No, I did not, but this is in Marion, Ohio, where my family was living at the time when I was about 8 years old. It was the first time I was allowed to stay up late on a Friday night to watch a movie, and it was an Elvis movie, Tickle Me.
Oh, Jesus.
Which, you know, again, though, there's an interesting story there. And, you know, from that point on, I was interested in it. And, you know, as I grew older, I really became fascinated by his music and you know, his range as a performer.
Yep. I thank / blame my mother. She was a huge Elvis fan. I remember being the one to tell her that there was a breaking news story back in 77 when he passed. I've always said that besides Elvis being one of the great entertainers, period, he's also one of the great show business what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he'd actually,
as much as he accomplished, there's a whole lot more, whole other levels
if
there.
If he had bopped Colonel Parker on the head and actually toured the world and had rights to his songs and made maybe a third less films, I mean, the possibilities were kind of endless in his case.
Yeah, and that's I assume that's the sort of stuff we're going to talk about. But it sort of culminated, too. You mentioned him dying in 77. My other great connection is I saw the last show.
Yes, you did.
I was there at Market Square Arena.
Willie Mays with the Mets?
Well, actually, my take on that was different because I went in there, you know, I knew he, even I think I was 18 at the time, not quite 18. I went to the show realizing, okay, this guy's not 22 years old anymore. He's not the hillbilly cat. He's not any of those things, and I've got to say the performances I recall of him singing a couple of the later songs, Hurt and Bridge Over Troubled Water, were incredibly moving, incredibly powerful performances. Did he walk through a lot of the early hits? You bet.
Oh, yeah.
You bet.
1 minute, 20-second versions of Hound Dog.
Yeah, and you could tell he was bored with it, but which became kind of a, you know, is a theme we probably will explore in the discussion here,
well,
too.
My only comparison I think of that, I never got to see him. We had a chance to get tickets to see him New Year's Eve 1976.
Oh, the famous
at
show
at the Pontiac
there, yeah.
Silverdome, and it just did not happen.
Yeah.
But I think of like when I saw Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry at the Chicago Blues Festival. This was in the late 90s, early aughts, and when they were on, they were on. And if they weren't, it was like Shaq at the free throw line. It was, you know, a very loud clang. So you kind of had to take the bitter with the sweet, I guess, in those cases.
Yeah. The difference between Elvis and Chuck is that I remember seeing a Chuck Berry show where literally he put down his guitar and started berating the audience.
Yeah,
Elvis never crossed that line.
Although, if you go on YouTube, there are some rants.
Yeah.
There are. But, you know, they never...
Not rarely directed toward the audience.
No, they were toward the evil media that is us.
Yeah.
But yeah, those somehow did not wind up on the RCA album, Having Fun with Elvis on Stage. Ladies and gentlemen, there is an entire RCA album of Elvis talking to the audience.
Saying thank you. Thank you very much, basically.
For 38 minutes.
It's really not memorable.
and if you look at those 70s albums, that's saying a lot. So.
Yeah, well, and that illustrates one of the problems. My understanding of that, too, is that wasn't technically an RCA thing.
Oh.
The Colonel put that out through his own label as a side deal to make money himself, in part because he was, you know, if the reporting I've read is accurate, he was deeply in hock in Vegas because of his gambling problem. So
yeah.
So
anyway, all right. With that in mind, let's start to break down the entire Elvis filmography. You're welcome, McKenna. Start us off. Where we begin? I know where we're beginning, but you're moderating this, so go ahead.
All right, we're gonna start off with 1956, "Love Me Tender."
Well.
It was not an Elvis vehicle. It turned into one.
It did, in part because they wanted to graft some songs onto it.
It was, I think, the Reno Brothers was the original title.
It was the original title. And, you know, the amazing thing there is that it really was sort of a B-Western that became this huge cultural phenomenon at the time because he was so big. You know, that's something in this age that we have trouble capturing because our, you know, our media, our culture, all of that have become much more fragmented, much more compartmentalized. We can't even process something as big as Elvis or the Beatles anymore. In 1956, the year that Love Me Tender came out, he sold one out of every nine records sold in the world.
Period. Fathom that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's like saying, you know,
yeah.
1956 dollars.
Yes. It's, yeah. No, I mean, it's huge, which means that I can't even think of, you'd have to combine about six or seven different performers to have that impact now.
I think an attempt where they tried to do that, and this is a bad example, and it's being able to cash in on something, is something like from Justin to Kelly.
Yeah.
The American Idol beach movie, because American Idol at that time was red hot, and they tried to capsize on that, and the results were mid-60s level at best, and that's not a compliment.
Yeah. The amazing thing, and you see all of really the good stuff and the bad stuff that would come from that first performance. I mean, there is a tremendous presence on the screen. You cannot avoid watching the guy. When he's there, you can tell he is untrained as an actor.
Or it was really like raw.
Yeah.
And he loved James Dean. He thought he could be or want to be like a James Dean type actor. Came close a couple times, but
he did, and we'll get to those. But and some of it though, even that was sort of a false trail for him because, Dean was Dean, and he had his own private demons and all of that sort of stuff that he was able to communicate. Elvis's gifts were a little bit less tortured than Dean's. He was somewhat less confused, I think. And the other thing is that places where he had success was really blazing his own trail, not trying to be an imitation. You look at the music, he takes a Big Boy Crudup song, and you listen to the original, and you listen, it's not an imitation of the blues.
No.
He's made it something else entirely different. And, by trying to be James Dean, he was working himself into a box when a large part of his career was about kicking the walls of the box down.
Very good, exactly. And again, it's a good Western. It's a decent Western. It's more interesting when he's, like you said, when he's on screen because of that dynamic and what he was trying to do.
Richard
with it.
Egan does not really radiate magnetism.
Exactly. All right. I don't have a bell. I don't have a chime. But here we go.
Okay.
All right. Next.
Right. 1957. Loving You.
And this is like a 50, this is one of the quintessential 50s kind of troubled teen films, because now you had films like Rock Around the Clock and where you were incorporating rock and roll music into movies. And I mean, and this would go even further in the late 60s, but the troubled teen who becomes a star. And he winds up doing a couple of these. But this one's, I like this one as well.
Well, and really, this one and then the next two, Jailhouse Rock and King Creole, are in some ways variations of his own story.
Yes.
It's about Elvis by another name becoming Elvis, becoming
the capital E.
The star. The thing that I find interesting about Loving You is I think that is most likely the closest we got on screen to what the stage performances were like at the time, because even in Jailhouse Rock or King Creole, the performances are highly stylized.
Yes.
In part because there were Hal Cantor, I think, actually, who directed Loving You, saw it as part of his mission to capture some of the Elvis phenomenon. He went down there, and I think he lived with Elvis for about a week and drove around with him and saw some of the performances and thought, okay, I want to capture as much of this energy as I can get on screen. So that's what makes it interesting. And then the other model that disappeared, I think, later in the film careers, there's a solid supporting cast there, too. Some very talented, Elizabeth Scott, Wendell Corey, talented people.
And we're going to get to those, especially when we get into the 60s, about who he had off coming off the bench.
Yeah.
Yes, I like to mix my sports with my arts. All right.
Yeah.
Next.
Same year, 1957, Jailhouse Rock.
Not a bad year.
No.
Of course, the famous title track, which he did the choreography for, although he never had stage dancers on stage.
They said it actually had been choreographed. The choreographer said, show me some of the moves you use on stage, and then I'll build a routine.
So he gets the second half of the and credit.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, and it's also one of the few, if not the only, Elvis performance or movie where for the bulk of the film he's supposed to be deliberately unlikable.
Right.
You know, he is a hardened jerk through much of the movie, and that, you know, in some ways that becomes a theme in the films too, that the bad boy has to be tamed.
I have to kill my phone.
That's
This is actually happening as we know it. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
You were saying, John, so sorry.
That's okay.
This is your pledge dollars at work, folks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I say, he was the bad boy who had to be tamed. And that to me has been one of the weaknesses of that film, is that it is a surly kind of drama with some great songs, perhaps if not the greatest score in the Elvis film canon, certainly one of them. And then at the end, it gets really, really saccharine. So,
yeah, it's still a 50s film.
It is, yeah.
All right. Next.
1958, King Creole.
This is probably my favorite.
It is mine, too.
It is directed by Michael Curtiz, the man who gave us Casablanca, among other things. You have Carolyn Jones, Walter Matthau, Vic Morrow. That's a strong supporting group.
Dean Jagger.
It's about as close to noir as Elvis is going to get. And same thing. Kind of a troubled guy who becomes a singer but gets pulled into the seedy underworld of show business in New Orleans. And it's the combination of, I think, his acting and music performances are some of the best.
Yes, I would agree that, you know, the reason I was chuckling is I remember when I was in grad school and talking with some friends who were film buffs too, and they made reference to the fact that Michael Curtiz directed this one and talked about Casablanca and Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then I said King Creole, and history will have to judge which was the best. At which point the conversation just descended from there.
And Milos Forman directed Hair.
So. But this one, I think, is also part of what the music is fabulous. The supporting performances are really exceptionally strong. It's also, I think, the most vulnerable we ever see Elvis.
Yeah.
On camera. There is a part of him, in part because he wanted to project that tough guy, surly. He wanted to be, you know, Dean or Brando, and I don't think he necessarily saw the vulnerability in either of those actors, too. But he wanted to project that kind of masculinity that he didn't do wounded all that often or do it all that well.
Right.
And in this, we see that. We see regret. And, of course, Curtiz makes beautiful use of the New Orleans location.
And that was a film I think around the same time, Panic in the Streets was a film that was shot down there. Also beautiful black and white. But, yeah, that was a city that wasn't, I don't think, utilized as much cinematically then.
Well, and I love that opening scene where he's standing on the balcony in the French Quarter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they sing the song Crawfish. But there is just something about it that is so evocative and so hypnotic almost.
And I think we can break down Colonel Parker, who to blame on where the path could have gone cinematically, but that was a pretty high point. And
he was poised for a major film career at that point. Yeah,
yeah. And so with that in mind, next.
1960 G.I. Blues.
Okay. Yeah.
This is where it begins to jump the rails. Yeah.
Because we have to make fun of him being in the army and Juliet Prowse is in it. So she's, I mean, by this point we get to how good is the female, and that's a terrible thing. How good is the foil? how good, if there is one, of the comedic sidekick. Forget music or storyline or anything else. It's like, who is he working with, and does it help? Prowse is good. As far, I think she's one of the better.
Oh, and they
ladies.
Had real, yeah, and they had real sparks. Mm-hmm. I gather they had an affair too while they were making the movie. But you know, some of that is true. I think there was also a conscious attempt. What we need to remember is that the rock and roll was still very much in its infancy at that point, and you know, at least in show business. Everyone was convinced that this was a fad, that it was going to disappear, and that you know, Elvis was kind of a cash cow who, you know, if he was going to outlive the fad, they had to try to transform him
Correct.
Into something else. You know, and what they were looking at was really trying to achieve you know, a lighter, younger Dean Martin or
something like
presence
that.
Like that, where he is this, you know, charming ladies guy who sings a few songs. And they saw the movies also as vehicles for selling the records.
Of course.
And all of that. You know, of these films, that's part of what went on there. But I don't think we can let Elvis entirely off the hook
no.
on that, because you know, he was 25 at the time. He was old enough to assert some control over what he was doing, and even when he had you know, if you want to do something instructive, Blue Suede Shoes was re-recorded for the G.I. Blues soundtrack. Listen to the original recording that he did in 56, listen to the one he did in 60, and then listen when he revisited in the 68 comeback special. And you can tell, there's a valley there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really did not care at all, didn't put any of the fire into it.
And we start shoving him into a studio with studio musicians who may or may not have the rock savvy, but they could play anything.
Well, and some of that also was the, you know, the contempt for what he was doing on the part of Hollywood. You know, the musicians, even going back to Love Me Tender, mm-hmm. the people who were backing him, you know, his original group of Scotty Moore and Bill Black and DJ Fontana auditioned to be his backup band in Love Me Tender, and the producers said, "No, you're not country enough." So instead, they got, you know, Hollywood studio musicians, you know, who were all but wearing sunglasses during a, you know, a 1860 Civil War drama.
Right,
but,
exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, remember, McKenna, as Bruno Kirby said in Spinal Tap, this is a fad.
So, yeah.
I know. That's unfortunate. All right, next.
1960, Flaming Star.
Another good director. It's Don Siegel. He had already done Invasion of the Body Snatchers and would later work with Clint Eastwood famously in Dirty Harry, Escape from Alcatraz, Coogan's Bluff.
And actually acted for Eastwood
That's
and
right.
Play Misty for Me, played the bartender,
That's
if
right.
I remember correctly.
And
yeah.
This was the guy who had a reputation of getting, and kind of Clint would also imitate it, get it in on time and under budget, and they for the most part would leave you alone. And Barbara Eden was in it. I always had a soft spot for Barbara Eden, and this was kind of a serious Western where he played for lack of a better term, the half-breed who has to decide which side he's going to fall upon.
Yeah, it's very much a product of that period. I mean, there are civil rights implications there, too, you know, a statement about prejudice. Long before it got to Elvis, I think it was originally conceived as a vehicle for Brando. And, you know, they worked their way down the pecking order,
right.
as it were, at that time. But he turns in, you know, a really credible performance. You get the sense, and I think it was Pauline Kael who said, if he had used this in King Creole as building blocks, he could have had a serious film career. And you always get the sense that was the ambition. Mm-hmm. You know, he originally had not wanted to even sing in the movies, and because he had contempt for the musical as an art form, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
and all of that, and, you know, found quickly that nobody, at least initially, was going to pay him at least the sums that Colonel Parker was asking for if he wasn't going to sing.
Yeah, so, that's unfortunate.
And they shoehorned. You know, the one weakness to that film, it's actually very, very taut. But because of that imperative, they sort of shoehorned four songs into it, where literally it is, okay, we're stopping now for a musical interlude.
Yep.
The story will pick back up in a moment.
It's like the films of the 40s when the big band would get a cameo, like Cab Calloway.
Yeah.
Or my favorite, it doesn't really stop the story, but I love Duke Ellington's cameo in Anatomy of a Murder playing piano with Jimmy Stewart. It's just it is one of those things where, okay, a musical interlude, go get popcorn.
Yes, yeah.
All right, next.
61, Wild in the Country.
Another ambitious project. Yeah.
Troubled man, and he's got, I believe, if I remember right, three girls to choose from. So it's a serious version of Spin Out. You have the nice girl, the trashy girl, and I think the teacher, librarian, that, all of them want to help him, or he needs comfort in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
You know, it's not his East of Eden, but it's kind of that troubled youth falling upon.
Well, it's close. He's he's a rejected by his birth family, as it were. And in this one, there are all sorts of, there are evocations of him as a would-be William Faulkner or Thomas Wolfe. He's a Southern writer, although I think the thing is set, has all of these sort of Southern atmospherics, but if I remember right, it's set in New England. So, which means his accent seems, slightly out of place. But, there is a resonance also to that performance as well. But the problem that it had and Flaming Star had is neither one of them did well at the box office.
Yeah, I think that, and that's a shame because,
they made money, but they didn't make tons of money.
Yeah, and that would become a thing that would later anchor the rest of that film. So, by the way, shout out to Tuesday Weld.
And that cast may be the only one that really could stand toe to toe with the King Creole cast.
Exactly. So, yeah. All right, next.
Same year, Blue Hawaii.
Well, now the travelogues begin.
Yeah.
First off, the better of the two Hawaiian films by default.
Three Hawaiian
films. Oh, that's right. Three.
Girls. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Of course, my other favorite snarky thing is, of course, his mother. He comes from a wealthy family, but he just wants to live on the beach and have a rock and roll lifestyle, studio version of rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah.
And does not want to deal with Big Daddy or Big Mama. And in this case, Big Mama is played by Angela Lansbury, who apparently was 9 years old when she had her son.
Yeah,
kind of like when she had her son, Lawrence Harvey, at the same age in the Manchurian Candidate.
Yes, yeah. No, it's it's one of those guilty pleasure movies because it really isn't very good in any way. The whole exercise, I guess, at some level is redeemed by the song, most famous song associated with it, Can't Help Falling in Love, which is a classic.
Yes.
And the performance is beautifully modulated and all of that, and sort of became Elvis's anthem, his thank you to his fans.
Correct.
But, the whole thing, he's not believable. The situation is not believable. And you literally can see it's like, okay, we've got however many weeks they take to shoot this thing. How many different Hawaiian backdrops can we work in here? We've paid for these cameras. By God, we're going to use them.
Did they shoot? They shot some of that on location, right?
Yeah,
so
they did.
He
did the benefit performance over
right.
there at the same time.
That's right.
Yeah.
I have a favorite moment of that was my wife was in the room with me. I was watching it one afternoon. And anytime I can get Lynn to look up from her laptop,
mm-hmm.
Just to notice something, it's a big deal. If she hears somebody or she recognizes, she'll kind of stop. And Angela Lansbury's first scene as the kvetching mother, wondering what's wrong with her son, and her and her husband, son and husband shouldn't fight. And she stops writing, watches the scene. Angela does as best she can and, runs off. And my wife just goes back to her laptop and says, even she can't make this crap sound good.
No. Well, and it's also the beginning of the truly, like the song has become kind of a punchline with several of my friends and me. Rockahula Baby, which and that scene has to be
look it up on
seen,
YouTube.
has to be seen to be believed. And the thing is, I mean, there is something that is oddly moving about watching that, because you can tell at that point the guy was still trying to make it work.
Yep.
You know, he's been handed this, you know, piece of fertilizer. And
I was going to say, make chicken salad.
Yeah. He's been here, and he's really trying to make it something watchable. And you know, it's like he narrowly misses and just goes flying off a cliff. So, at that point, So, I'm not sure I can describe it any more fully than that.
Meanwhile, on the and that became a story. Like, I don't know how well you know the films of Cliff Richard, which is kind of he's the English Elvis, and it was very, you know, The Young Ones was similar to that. Of he came from a wealthy family, but he wants to, you know, his father is played by Robert Morley. I love cinematic gene pools.
Yeah.
You know, and they're going to tear down the youth club, so he's going to
Sean Connery and Harrison Ford too.
And
Sean Connery, Dustin
Hoffman, Matthew Broderick, and Family Business.
Yeah.
We'll do that later, another show, Cinematic Gene Pools. But, yeah, but it's similar, you know, saving the youth center by putting on a show because you're ashamed of your rich lifestyle. So, yeah, that's the travelogues begin. Next.
1962, Follow That Dream.
Not as many songs. I don't remember a performance in it.
And a comedic gift. There are several. I mean, he does Follow That Dream, which is one of the better Elvis songs.
Generally, it's like the title track plays over the credits, and that's...
Yeah, and
it.
He does On Top of Old Smokey, and a couple of others. But again, it is, and it's a comedy, and he shows some comedic chops there.
Yeah, this was a family that I think they declared the land in Florida their own country, and you know, just wanted to be left alone. And yeah, he's actually good in that.
Well, and it's odd because his character, you know, in some ways the closest. You know, point of comparison would be like Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies, but it's a much more subtle kind of take.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when Max Baer Jr. was doing the whole, he couldn't help kind of winking at the audience, saying, "I'm just playing a character here. I'm really not." Like with Elvis, there was a real kind of sweetness and innocence to the performance that you know, even with something like that, he could have built.
Yep.
He could have built on it.
So we have a little bit of range between the musical stuff and the troubled, you know, the angst-ridden stuff, and then a touch of light comedy.
Yeah.
I always remember there was, I guess, a famous story that Tom Petty got to meet Elvis because they shot it down in...
Oh, that's right, down in Florida.
Down in Florida. And nice locations. And that was another one. I don't think we saw a lot of the Everglades or the, you know, the non-beach portions of Florida. You know, usually that was saved for... Where the Boys Are, the Spring Break movies.
Well, and we're going to get to perhaps one of the great Elvis movie moments in a little while. Another film set in Florida, Clambake.
Yes, we'll get to that.
Where, you know, you look in the concluding scene where Elvis's character proclaims his love for Shelley Fabre's character, and you look over the hero's shoulder and you see mountains, real Florida mountains in the background.
Like the mountains of Muncie, Indiana. Yeah,
that's
Close
it.
Encounters,
you got it.
The Illinois mountains in The Fugitive, or
you
the mountains
it, yeah.
in Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Thank you, Vancouver. So,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Next.
62 again. Kid Galahad.
Another
decent film.
Remake of you know, the boxing picture, and your trainer is a non-psychotic Charles Bronson, and. Appears to be non-soused Gig Young.
Yeah,
decent.
It is. It's actually one of my, you know, favorites to watch because again, everything seems relaxed. That you know, the performances are assured. Elvis is believable in character. You know, I gather that the guy who did the training for. The boxing did not find him particularly gifted, which is a little surprising given all the karate he'd done and the fact that he seemed to be, you know, naturally gifted at movement and all of that sort of stuff. But it doesn't communicate on screen. I mean, the boxing sequences are believable. The romance with Joan Blackman's character is a lot more natural and unforced than they had, you know, like this brother-sister thing going on in Blue Hawaii that was mildly disturbing.
Yes.
And, you know, here it seems much more natural.
Yeah, so underplayed, good bench. Yeah, mm-hmm. a well done one. Very good.
Yeah.
Next.
Finishing out 62 with Girls, Girls, Girls.
That's right.
Back to Hawaii.
Back to Hawaii. Stella Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there after a while. Like,
was it Jeremy? Is it Stevens is the actor who sort of plays the foil?
I think so. There got to be. I think I don't need Elvis in like danger or seeking treasure.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's. I'm pretty good with not having those, which we'll get to later in the decade.
Yeah.
But shoot it on location with pretty girls and kind of throw a story in there as an afterthought.
Well, and it had Return to Sender, another.
Another. That was the last charting hit until 68, 69.
Well, no, because.
Well, major charting.
Yeah, because he. There's an interlude that wasn't associated with the movies. Actually, Crying in the Chapel.
That's right.
Charted in 65. But yeah, and it's a Bumps Blackwell song and all of that. You saw far fewer of those top flight songwriters actually being associated with many of these films too. So in addition to the movies not being as good, the music also wasn't as good, and you could tell he was becoming bored with it. Too.
Yeah.
It's not one of my favorites. In part, you talk about Elvis looking for treasure. With perhaps one exception, Elvis singing children's songs to children just doesn't seem, you know.
Yeah, we'll get to my daughter in a little bit.
Yeah, well, and it's and you could tell that's another thing they decided that. There was a sequence in G.I. Blues where he did a puppet show, and he sang Wooden Heart, which was never a huge hit in the United States, but apparently just exploded in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, oh, there's money to be made from doing this. So that became sort of the trend of having him repeatedly in films sing to small children.
Thanks, Bean Counters.
Yes.
All right, next.
1963, It Happened at the World's Fair.
We are continuing our travelogue, the travelogue.
And children again,
and
too.
Children, yes, right. And Yvonne Craig,
mm-hmm.
Batgirl for you guys out there. And he's a crop duster. All crop dusters should look like 60s Elvis Presley.
and have the kind of wardrobes, too.
That's true. Well-dressed crop dusters.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was... I know a little bit about expensive clothing, and I could tell you, you know, the only crops that produce that kind of cash are generally illegal. So.
I think they were the Winter Kills producers.
Yeah.
And I think also this wasn't this for a lot of people the introduction to the world? I mean, instead of watching the 10-minute short about the World's Fair, you got a movie about the World's Fair.
Yes. And, you know, it was the Space Needle was relatively new. You got shots of that. You know, about the best I can say about that movie is it isn't the worst of them. But you really began to see a serious slide here because it's like there's not even a song there ultimately to redeem the
I remember the song Relax. That's the one where he's trying to seduce Yvonne Craig, and she shows a little bit of physical humor. Being basically the cat in the Pepe Le Pew cartoons.
Yeah.
The other trivia note, ladies and gentlemen, is at the World's Fair, he falls for a nurse.
Joan O'Brien.
And in order to get closer to the nurse, he hires a kid. He gives a kid a nickel to kick him in the shins so he can go and see the nurse. And that kid was played by?
Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Who later played Elvis in a TV miniseries. And the performance, Kurt Russell's performance is phenomenal.
Kurt Russell has acted with Elvis, played Elvis, played an Elvis impersonator and done voiceover for Elvis in Forrest Gump.
Yes.
So, and there's more Kurt Russell trivia involving this later. So, yeah, that's, but otherwise pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
Next.
Fun in Acapulco.
Not shot in Acapulco.
No.
The two things for me with this.
Elvis and Kids again.
Elvis and Kids. Ursula Andress.
Yeah.
Or as my dad always said, Ursula Undress.
I know.
Because my dad is of a generation.
Yeah.
But when my daughter was into watching Elvis movies, I actually used a scene from I did an anatomy of a scene with Fun in Acapulco because it's the scene where he's a former circus trapeze artist, and there was an accident because it's flashbacks and serious music. And Elvis goes to the pool, and he sees the diving board, and and serious music is playing, and they cut to Elvis, and they cut to the board, and then we get a flashback. And I talked Emma through this, and she's like, oh, you know, I saw her little cinematic light bulb go off, and I went, I can't believe we did Anatomy of a Scene, not with Bergman, not with Scorsese or Coppola. No, it was an Elvis movie, and this one of all of them.
Yeah, well, and this one was probably, you know, that they all fall into there. At this point, with perhaps one, maybe two exceptions going forward, we're talking about misses rather than
same
hits.
Same film three times a year.
Yeah, but this one has a special because it's, it's like the biggest missed opportunity because it is a substantial cast, you know, of attractive and talented rising stars. I mean, Ursula
Andress,
she had just done Dr. No. That, you know, she was considered a huge emerging talent at that point. Alejandro Rey was in it.
That's right.
He played kind of the foil. He, you know, Elvis had someone to work against who could hold the screen with him. And, you know, it just didn't work, in part because, unlike King Creole or even, you know, Blue Hawaii, it's set in Acapulco. And apparently, you know, there was some controversy. Supposedly something had, a quote had been misappropriated to him that seemed to denigrate Mexicans, and they had security concerns about shooting down there. Although one might wonder, given the Machiavellian nature of the
Colonel Parker's
saying, it's more expensive to go down there. We can shoot in this parking lot right here, and everything will be just fine because it's Elvis.
Look up the Colonel's passport. That'll help.
Explain it. Yeah.
All right. Next.
64 Kissin' Cousins.
Oh, this is one of the worst. This is a musical based on the Patty Duke Show.
Yeah.
The army wants a section of some of the hill country, and Elvis is going to help out because he has an identical blonde cousin, which there's a little peak of sadness because you think about his twin dying at birth, and I wondered how much of that, if it any, resonated.
Well, and I think also that movie, you know, conforms to the worst stereotypes of Appalachian whites.
Makes little Abner look like Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's real. So, you know, I mean, and that's the part of the country, the cultural landscape that my mother's people come from. So, you know, I watch that, and, you know, I mean, that one presumes with a name like Presley and all of that's part of the cultural landscape that he came from. You know, the humor is incredibly forced, and what there is of it, it's always the hill people who are the butt of the joke.
Yep.
Is a reason, I think, that he hated making that movie. He hated wearing the wig.
Yeah, there was also I don't remember if they did a split screen like on the Patty Duke Show, but there was always somebody, some double with the back to the camera.
Lance LeGault. And there's actually a pretty famous scene near the end of it when they're shooting the big finale.
Okay.
And this was, you know, a production of Sam Katzman, whose nickname was Sam Quickie Katzman, because he did films really, really briskly and really, really cheaply. And, you know, so the Colonel had found his guy there.
Oh, God.
And there is a scene where they're shooting the big finale where everybody's singing, you know, and I think the camera guy missed the shot or whatever, and you can see there's Elvis and there's Lance LeGault standing side by side, and you can tell clearly that it's Lance LeGault. Somebody points it out. Katzman says, no, I don't want to spend the money to get it again. So it goes out that way. The whole thing was shot in 3 weeks.
Oof, gosh, and it shows.
It does.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, at the time this film, nobody had planned on home video.
Yeah.
That it was just going to air. And even if somebody had a quick eye and went, is that... You just move on. You couldn't find it again unless it came on TV. And again, you didn't have a pause button.
Well, and you know the amazing thing is, the film that she's going to talk about next, Viva Las Vegas, Call Us On, actually was shot before Kissing Cousins.
It's that they went through it that fast.
And part of it, we'll talk about the implications of this sequence because this is really the point when Elvis's film career just jumps the rails completely.
And with that in mind, next.
Viva Las Vegas.
Of the frothy comic musicals that he would pump out three times a year, this is the best.
By far.
By far.
By far. You know, it co-stars Anne Margaret.
The last real, well, up until, and we'll get to a couple other actresses, but the last real actress that could stand toe-to-toe when it came to performance, singing, sexuality, comedy. I mean, they bounced off each other really well, on and off.
And they had, tremendous chemistry. They had an affair as well, which I gather was sort of a commonplace for him.
An actor having an affair with a leading lady.
It's a, you know, as I said to a friend once who was going through a divorce and bought a waterbed and all of that, I said, you know, you're one set of neck chains away from becoming a cliche. in this case, it worked in part because it also, the pacing was incredibly brisk. Mm-hmm. You could tell he cared about what he was doing. I think one of the best moments we have of him on film is when he's in that scene where he thinks he has lost Anne Margaret. And, you know, he's not acting. Initially, there's kind of a voiceover performance of a ballad, I Need Somebody to Lean On. But he is conveying all of the confusion and the pain and the hurt and all of that. And you realize, you know, if this guy had been given good material, he could have been something special. Mm-hmm. Which gets to your point, about the great might have been's. As much as he accomplished, moments like that tell us that it could have been a heck of a lot more.
And that film did well. It didn't do great. And because I was a commentary track on this, but because it wasn't a monster hit, Colonel Parker went back to Sam and just started pumping out.
Yeah, well, and there was a lot going on at the point that came out. In part, the Colonel was not on board with having, you know, Elvis share the screen with other strong presences because
crazy.
Yeah, he in fact was complaining all the way through the production that Anne Margaret was getting too much screen time, and all of that. But the other thing that was going on is at this point, you know, Elvis had been the biggest star in music for close to a decade. And he had his first really serious threat. The Beatles had arrived in America.
I remember, what was it? I'm sure there have been several articles, and you can find those, of what songs the Beatles were doing that year and what songs Elvis were doing that year. And you see the writing on the wall of that. That's a fun. And by the way, after this one, I'm good with no races. No racing pretty much for the rest of whatever. Also, with the power of the pause button, they do a really fun duet of What I Say. And in the gymnasium, one of the dancers in the very front, if you push pause, a young Terry Garr.
Yes, she did several of those.
Several of those, So I don't know. I have to look if she's been interviewed talking about those. I'd like to figure out how she got involved.
I think she was, when she did a David Letterman show years ago, she talked about being in several of the Elvis movies.
Cool. I'll have to find that. So, yeah. All right. So, yeah, that's one. Here we go. Next.
Roustabout.
I actually like this. It's another example of, apparently Colonel Parker never played tennis.
Yeah.
Because you need somebody equal or better to bounce off of. And he got a chance to work off Barbara Stanwyck. And it's not bad. It's a carnival story about the troubled 20-something working in the carnival. But I like the work he did with Stanwyck.
Yeah, well, and when I watched that film, I can't even remember the actress's name, the young ingenue type that Elvis is supposed to be in love with, in part because even when I watched it when I was young, I thought, why is he chasing after this little girl when Barbara Stanwyck is available?
Yeah.
I mean, why? And, that would have been a bold and
interesting choice.
To go with that route, again, and that it shows, one of the big musical moments there is, he does an old R&B hit, Little Egypt, and does it with conviction. It comes back again, obviously, in the 68 comeback special.
Yep.
And I think that album was the last one to go to number one. For him, maybe in the 60s. I mean, even the stuff at American Studios and all of that, I don't think topped the charts. I don't think he got back to number one on the album charts until Aloha from Hawaii.
Wow. There's some good stuff in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes, yeah, so. Really good.
All right, next.
1965, Girl Happy.
Elvis on spring break. Yeah. But he's not on spring break. He's on he's on duty on spring break. Following a mobster's daughter. This is the first of the Shelley?
Let's see. Yeah, let's see. It was Girl Happy.
Spin Out.
And then Clambake.
And Clambake, yeah. John Fiedler has a bit in this for you fans of Winnie the Pooh, the voice of Piglet. But he's the kind of nervous motel manager.
Yeah.
And this is already after Where the Boys Are and Palm Beach Holiday. I mean, all this and the kind of Frankie and Annette type stuff.
Well, and you could tell, among other things, they're beginning to struggle with what to do with the fact that Elvis isn't 22
Correct.
Anymore. That he, around that time he'd turned 30, and it's less so now that we see the Rolling Stones continuing to do rock and roll into their 70s, and these acts performing, it's not as big a deal, but at that time,
if we were 30 and hanging out in Fort Lauderdale, there'd be a problem.
Well, and also that the whole notion of, it wasn't that far away before, the Who were singing, I Hope I Die Before I Get Old. It really was a concern that, this was only about the kids. So I always thought, okay. Instead of making him the young rebel type, the threat to order and authority, we transform him into the school chaperone now.
Right.
That works about as well as you would anticipate.
We wish all. I'm sure a lot of ladies thought they wished all chaperones looked like 30-year-old Elvis.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Next.
Tickle Me.
Oh, jeez.
The only thing, and maybe because this was the first Elvis movie
I understand.
I saw, I have a sentimental attachment to it, even though it is not a good movie.
Elvis at a dude ranch, and there's a treasure, and there's bad guys floating.
And they're all dressed in masks.
That's right.
And it's a haunted dude ranch.
So it's a Scooby-Doo episode, basically, before Scooby-Doo came out.
But this is one place where the Colonel's cost-cutting instincts actually, I think, helped the movie, other than the fact that it probably never should have been made. But because he did not want to go to the expense of recording a new soundtrack, the soundtrack, all the songs, are taken from early 60s Elvis studio albums. So you're hearing, there are several cuts from what is one of Elvis's best albums, Elvis Is Back, the one that he recorded right after he got out of the Army, and just screams, "Release! I am free again, and I can do what I want." Those are, you know, that makes the soundtrack. And I think that's part of what spoke to me, is because when I look at that and you look at the movies that sort of surrounded in that period, there's no comparison.
Correct. That's correct. So, yeah, I'll have to maybe give that one another shot. But I understand.
Well, you can try. The other thing is that I think the you can spare yourself the pain associated with the experience by just ordering the soundtrack album through the Follow That Dream label, so you can just hear the songs.
Very good. And I know, I think they did an Elvis Is Back Deluxe Edition.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's phenomenal.
Cool.
That's
all right. Phenomenal. Next.
Harum Scarum.
Okay. Elvis on a movie set, and there's a kidnapping, and then there's songs. And that's kind of...
And he's supposed to be this movie star who's kind of like...
Who looks like this...
Rudolph Valentino.
Sure.
But because he's a sheik, at least, one of the initial scenes.
Not the wrestler, the sheik.
Who somehow manages to kill a tiger with a single karate chop. and all of that. But it is... I wish I could say this was the Nader, but no,
it keeps
gets
going.
Me on.
We're only in 1965. My story with this is I had friends at Ball State who took a history of music course taught by a man named Ralph Strobel. I guess you have to look this up, but the last week of classes, they finally got to rock and roll. So my buddies were really excited. And then he says, "We're going to listen to Elvis." And they get really excited. He plays the Harum Scarum soundtrack because Ralph Strobel apparently played oboe on the session for film. Take that.
Well,
from Shostakovich and the Elizabethan era to Harum Scarum.
And the other thing is that about that movie, you can tell he is at some level checking out. He's not quite at the point where... in a couple of the later ones, Clambake, that we've talked about already, and Easy Come, Easy Go, if you watch closely, you can actually see him looking off to the side and reading the cue cards.
It's like a Saturday Night Live guest.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really, he'd always, at some level, tried to take the music seriously up to this point, but you can tell on several of the songs, okay. And if you this stuff's now available. They have a lot of the outtakes, and you'll hear him saying things like, "I literally do not know what to do with a POS like this. You know, I just don't know, how to sing it, how to make it believable."
That's not good if you're a singer.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Next.
1966, Frankie and Johnny.
Another disappointment.
Yeah, you had Donna Douglas already. For you fans of the Beverly Hillbillies, this is a film that has Harry Morgan singing.
It does. And it's one of the Jordanaires.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. But it was sort of a break from the mold because it's on a riverboat and it's supposed to be let's take the old standard Frankie and Johnny and stretch it out into a 90-minute movie, and you probably get about 60 minutes worth.
Well, and the problem is that. You know, the whole Frankie and Johnny, the song...
Doesn't end well.
No, but it would have made an interesting story. Yep. An interesting movie because it's about betrayal. It's about expectation. And in its way, it's a story song about mature people and all of that. And instead, it's just a light and frothy costume drama.
With a tagged-on ending...
Yeah,
where he, spoiler alert on a 50-year-old film, but a flask keeps a bullet from hitting him. Not since the film version of Our Town, when they wake up and realize it was all a dream. I'm like, really? You're going to pull that stunt?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. No, it was. And again, you look at the places where the thing could have been turned around or resurrected. this is another one of those huge missed opportunities.
Yep. Next.
Paradise Hawaiian Style.
Okay, we already...
This is the Nader, as far as I'm concerned. This is it. This is it.
Didn't need two films set in Hawaii. Didn't need three films. Well, didn't need this. Did not need this.
Yeah.
Did you ever see the film Heaven Help Us?
No.
It's an underrated... It's from 1985, and I'll get to the film. But it's set in a Catholic school in the Bronx. Young Andrew McCarthy, young Kevin Dillon, Donald Sutherland is the head of the Brotherhood. Wallace Shawn has a cameo. John Hurd is the young kind of hip. Yeah, Mary Stuart Masterson is the girl. It's kind of advertised as a horny teenager movie, like a Animal House. It's got a lot more heart to it. But there's a scene where the Pope is riding through New York, and the four boys, young Patrick Dempsey is in it as well. They skip out and they go see Paradise Hawaiian Style, and Kevin Dillon's comment is he finally lights up a cigarette in the theater and looks at the screen and says, "What did he do to Elvis? Cut his balls off?"
Yeah.
And that's, well, literally and figuratively, I guess, and more figuratively. So.
Well, and it's, I mean, let me put it this way. In one of the songs in there, and there are several Elvis contribution to Hell's Top 40.
We'll have that list for another show.
Yeah, but A Dog's Life is certainly there. And I think the thing that is so disappointing about it is you could tell even with that soundtrack, though, that he's trying new vocal approaches, anything to try to make it work. If there's anything that has even a modicum of value to it, you know, there's a much fuller sound to his voice and all of that. You could tell he had done some extensive training and all of that, and you think, oh God, all that effort, for something that is, would have to improve considerably to be awful. So, yeah.
And these are quotes you won't see in the ad campaigns. Yeah,
no.
Next.
Spin Out.
Okay, another racing film, Elvis with three girls. Somebody has told, actually, somebody who works here, that there was the theory was that somebody tried to make a spoof of an Elvis movie, and that this was it, but it wound up being played straight. Have you heard this?
I have not heard that.
Okay.
But, it's,
race car driver, three girls to choose from.
Now, the one thing I will say is, it was a shorter soundtrack for the film. And every movie, with a few exceptions, had an album associated with it, released. And even when he wasn't selling at the 1950s level, he was still selling at, 250,000 albums for even some that weren't particularly good, the soundtracks. This one, to flesh it out, to get it to album length, they added what they called bonus songs, which became a new thing.
Yep.
But in this case, there is an absolutely exquisite cover of Bob Dylan's Tomorrow is a Long Time.
Right.
That is just, it's 5.5 minutes long, and just this really, really lovely rendering of that song. He does I'll Remember You for the first time. He's recorded that, and this is at a time you can tell the guy is almost desperate to get back into the studio and do something that has some meaning instead of all of this.
Wasn't this the film that had Do the Clam?
No, that's Girl Happy.
Oh, I stand
corrected. That's another one of Hell's Top 40.
Written by, was it Dolores Taylor, for you Ed Wood fans out
now,
there?
No, I hate to tell you this, but even as bad as some of those songs are, some of the songs, they still are not going to knock Billy Don't Be a Hero out of the number one spot.
I'm gonna get John Kroll's Hell's Top 40 okay. later, but that's fun. All right. Next.
1967, Easy Come, Easy Go.
Okay, so going after sunken treasure, former Navy guy, Pat Harrington is your comedic sidekick.
renders good service.
Yep. There. And Pat Priest in a bikini for you fans of the Munsters.
Yeah.
And of all things, I think one of the final performances from Elsa Lanchester as a. This was also a film that this was a major studio that was. This was that time where you started to poke fun at the counterculture.
Well,
and they do that in this.
Yeah, and some of it is also. Again, you look at this in the context of what was going on in Elvis's life. It's a time. This is a guy who was who. The perception of him is that he was just sort of this, unconscious artist, that he didn't think through anything or any. And, if you listen to the recording sessions and the kind of choices and the fact that almost inevitably, he was producing his own sessions from the beginning, basically from the moment he left Sam Phillips down in Memphis till the day he died, he produced his own sessions. But he knew he was lost. He knew he was adrift. He had turned increasingly toward Eastern religions and alternative lifestyles. He was really on this spiritual quest, and had begun dabbling in yoga. And another one of Hill's top 40.
Yoga
here.
Is as yoga does.
Yoga is as yoga does, which is designed to insult that whole movement. And he looks incredibly uncomfortable while he's doing. It not just because it's being played for comedy, but he was smart enough to know that he was being insulted at that point.
There's a scene of body painting, girls in bikinis being rolled in paint and rolled. Yeah, because that was the big studio's impression of the counterculture. Because making fun of Dobie Gill, the beatniks of the 50s and the hippies of the 60s. Well, they're easy fodder when you're a big studio, even though the studios were starting to crumble at this time.
Yeah.
Next.
Double Trouble.
Okay. Elvis in Danger. Don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis in Europe. Not in Europe. In the MGM, the Universal MGM UA lot. But not a film that's going to age even more so in the Me Too movement, because you have Elvis teamed up with a 17-year-old girl.
Well, the
running,
actress was not 17.
No, but the character. The
is
character,
supposed to be 17.
And the running bit is they keep waiting for her to turn 18. Ugh. And General Burkhalter and Michael Murphy are in this film.
Even though he is, they've set it up so that, and this is... again, sort of about the neutering of Elvis Presley on film too. The Annette O'Day, who was the actress,
correct,
is sexually the aggressor all the way through the movie, which you could tell that they were queasy about this even to begin with. Although it's odd, to some degree, what was going on in Elvis's life. Was that he was waiting? He was waiting for Priscilla to get old enough so he could marry her.
So this is Elvis's version of charade,
yes,
or walk, don't run.
Yeah,
and he's not Gary Grant.
But and it might have been workable if it just,
This song, this film also features him singing "Old MacDonald."
Oh yes, yes.
Top 41.
Oh yeah. Well, you can tell that they don't. The traditional sort of Tin Pan Alley songwriters they were going for, the professionals, you could tell even then at that point, up until this point, musicals by and large often, the ones that weren't taken from Broadway musicals or weren't conscious artistic things would have filler songs in them,
yep,
or things that weren't, but they were well-crafted. Elvis's early films, even if the songs were not great, you could tell there was at least a level of professional craftsmanship there. The big, what is supposed to be the showstopper song here, is Long Legged Girl with a short dress on, that clocks in at like a minute and 20 seconds. You could tell, I wrote a verse, I'm done. Give me my check. I fulfilled my obligation.
No 3-hour musicals in the Elvis canon at all.
No.
Next.
Clam Bake.
Okay. Race. Bill Bixby is your foil. And my daughter, when she was younger, this was her favorite because it was her first time of seeing Elvis sing the children.
Yeah.
And that's really about it.
Which is unfortunate because that may be the single worst Elvis Sings to Children song. Yeah. I mean, the song is called Confidence,
oh, yeah.
which is supposed to be kind of Elvis's answer to Frank Sinatra's High Hopes. But it's like he spells it out, goes C-O-M-F-I-D, and then at the end of the song, it's like, oh, you can tell the songwriters decided, I can't make anything else work with this, with the rhythm scheme or rhyming or anything like that, so we're just going to say, and ends.
Yeah.
And he moves on. And it is truly atrocious. But again, and this is even in the worst films, you see these moments, and this, by the way, I think is one of the worst.
Yeah.
You know, I've already referenced the mountains in Florida and all of that. And he sings another song about goop.
Yeah.
In there, which has to be seen to be believed. But then there is just this absolutely exquisite rendering of, song made famous by Eddie Arnold and Ray Charles, You Don't Know Me.
Yep.
That, is sublime. And the fact that it is in this,
not chicken salad.
Mountain of feces is what makes it, all the more moving.
It's Steve Carlton winning a Cy Young with the 72 Phillies.
Yeah.
27 victories, 62 wins as a whole.
Yeah.
So there you go. Next.
1968, Stay Away, Joe.
Okay. we said earlier about Elvis playing a half-breed in Flaming Star, and this is in the time-honored tradition of this is not at the Idle Jorg. This is your great cinematic Native American characters, Burt Lancaster, Paul Newman, Martin Landau, Chuck Connors. This is bad.
Oh,
and it's Burgess Meredith and Joan Blondell, and it's supposed
there's a
to be
lot of talent wasted.
Yeah,
in this movie.
It's supposed to be a rollicking hell. I believe the subhead for the poster was he doesn't say how, he says when. It's that, folks.
Yeah, yeah, and Elvis is supposed to be this hustler. You can tell they are trying to move him toward
something,
a more adult kind of screen presence, because Joan Blondell's character, there are allusions in the film that her character and Elvis had a relationship earlier on. Now Elvis is kind of chasing after her daughter, which creates some disquieting elements and all of that, but that she was the older woman in his life, it's maddening, it's odd. A few years ago with my family, we were on vacation in Sedona where it was shot. And
did you take the tour?
Well, no, but it's we took a tour of Sedona, one of the pink Jeep tours that they do, where the big thing is that they'll run you up these really steep climbs on the thing because they've worked it out, and if it's less than four. But the guy's pointing out and say talks about the movies that have been shot in the area, and one of them he pointed out to like this butte and said, if you watch the movie Stay Away Joe, there's a very young Elvis singing up there. And I needed to say, well, no, he really wasn't singing, he was lip syncing at that point, but getting the recording equipment up there might have been a little tough. So, another thing where there could have been a possibility of an interesting story there. Scenery is gorgeous. I mean, it's an incredible setting. Yeah.
And it was another one where it wasn't quite the same film three times a year. It was something slightly different.
Well, and you could tell he was trying to break out and play a character who at least was somewhat closer to his age, too.
Yes. I always remember
he was in his early 30s at that point.
This year, of course, marked the 50th anniversary of the big explosion in downtown Richmond.
Yeah.
And this was the film that was playing in the theater at time of the explosion. We learned this through the Wayne County Historical Society. But my wife was my wife teaches theater at Earlham. She was she was helping out with a one act about that day. And I get the call from my wife going, do you have the soundtrack to Stay Away, Joe? I said, I have the song because there's the myriad of movie compilations. Yeah. I went, yeah, I actually have the title track. I'll bring it in. So, you know, there's something out of that. I also remember Elvis got a nomination in the Golden Turkey Awards written by the Medved brothers of worst. I'm going to forget the category, but it's
worst racial stereotype. Or Indian or something.
He's up against Chicano actor Robbie Benson in Walk Proud. And, of course, the winner was Marlon Brando and Tea House on the August Moon. That's hard to top. So
it's been so long. This is not one of the films I have seen more than once. I think it once was enough. But you know, I know with this, you know, he did the sort of peppy Stay Away Joe title track.
Yep.
But then there was an alternate version, Stay Away, that is done to Greensleeves, that again is is lovely, and you think, it's like consistently the people who were handling him, you could see whenever we come to the fork in the road, let's choose the one that can do the most damage to this guy's aspirations and his dreams and all of that. And I'm not relieving him of responsibility because he was a grown man.
Shot TVs. He could have done something to himself.
And he was, you can make an argument that he was the most single most powerful figure in entertainment for a period of time. I mean, the Beatles, at least during the 60s, I mean, what we overlook it, we think of him as a huge 50s act. But he actually was the second biggest record seller in the 60s, too, behind the Beatles.
He just didn't have the rights to his own music until 1973.
Well, actually, no. It's worse than that.
Oh, worse than that?
He owned the rights. The Colonel sold them for a one-time payment. And then there was litigation after that.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And the hits just keep on coming.
Yep.
Next.
Speedway.
Okay,
real attempt here.
Because, and I say no more races. However, Nancy Sinatra is not Anne Margaret, but she does
have the closest sense. And Bill Bixby.
Bixby is this time comedic sidekick as opposed to smarmy foil.
And Gail Gordon.
That's right. And
William Shower.
Thank you. Yes, with the carload of kids for him to sing to.
And so probably the one exception to the Elvis should not sing to children rule.
That one?
Is he does a lovely, for anyone who's the father of a daughter, Your Time Hasn't Come Yet, Baby, has a real kind of emotional resonance when he and Nancy Sinatra sing a couple of duets, you could tell there's some sparks there.
Yep.
Let Yourself Go is a powerful performance.
Yeah, that's the first. I think there was a couple of them. I believe, first off, club owner Carl Ballantyne doing the spotlight when a celebrity shows up into a club, they are forced to sing because they are famous. So, and that happens in this one. But dear IRS, make more agents look like Nancy Sinatra.
Oh, yeah, that's well. speaking before we move on, we got to add another one.
Yes.
To Hell's Top 40. He's your uncle, not your dad.
People are going to YouTube frantically now with this Spotify Hades list. Yeah. So, next.
Live a little, love a little.
Okay. I use the term with the romantic. There are certain, I call them psychotic romantic comedies. The Rock Hudson Doris Day stuff, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, My Best Friend's Wedding. If normal-looking people acted the way people acted in those, you would need a restraining order. But because it's Julia Roberts and Matthew McConaughey, there's a woman that keeps him trapped in a house and in the water for 3 days
and costs him his job.
And this might have been the origin of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah.
The same year was Sandy Dennis in Sweet November, where she kind of takes over Anthony Newley's life in the same way.
Yeah, and I've got to say, this film,
Michelle Carey
and Dick Sargent is in it.
Dick Sargent's in it. Yep. And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think who the. Well, anyhow, what's interesting is this is a film where you get the sense if they had had more time.
Mm-hmm.
they might actually have been able, because the first like half an hour, 40 minutes of it, well, I find it, it's got a real kind of loopy charm.
I think,
and
they could have sliced it in half.
And all of that, but then you could just see, it's like, okay, the writers did not know where to go with it. And of course, shoehorning the songs in, which was increasingly becoming an imperative.
And I think if you take the songs out, and I mean, I love Edge of Reality, even though it's a weird dream sequence, and
a little less conversation.
Hello, fans of Ocean's 11, that's the remix. You take those out, it's a Tony Curtis film.
It is in a lot of ways. And Tony Curtis was one of Elvis's early idols, too.
Right, and this is because this is the kind of lightweight romantic comedy that Curtis was stuck in until The Boston Strangler.
Yeah.
So this one, it's okay. And then, yeah, there's...
You mean Boston Strangler was not a lightweight romantic comedy?
It depends on who you talk to, really.
Okay.
But yeah, there's also... He winds up getting the two jobs.
I didn't sleep for 2 years after seeing that movie, so... That was a joke, folks.
That's over Boston Strangler. But yeah, there's a magazine that's not Playboy, and then there's another magazine that's not Vogue.
Oh, Rudy Valley Rudy Valley. Which is a reference, you know. That.
So it's he's older. It's yeah, he's not 20. He's not 25.
But the other thing that, and also there is, for the first time, I think, in Elvis films, a real attempt to deal with the question of sex, you know, in a way that is not, to use the cliche from film criticism and all of the other movies, it's like they could have been made in the 1940s where the kiss is the climax.
Correct.
You know, in this one, you have Elvis and his leading lady sharing a bed. Now, again, using the sort of 40 style conventions, they have a board separating them.
Thank you. It happened one night.
And she makes, there's even some comedic byplay where, you know, she says she got a splinter and he says, you know, that's what you get for trying to climb fences. and all of that. But then there is a moment when, when they have resolved their differences and it looks like there's going to be a romance where the board gets thrown away and it's clear. Okay, the kiss is not going to be the climax this time.
And sometimes a board is just a piece of wood.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Next.
1969, Charo.
The spaghetti western attempt in the United States.
Yeah. It's
okay.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's different. If anything, I think there was that kind of relief of, you know, if you've been starving and you get a Ritz, I guess, you know, it's the best Ritz cracker. But after, you know, so like it's not. This comes after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and the way of Django and the wave of Italian westerns, and they tried to make one in the United States.
Yeah, and the direction is basic. That's about the best you can say about that. You know, again, you get a sense the guy is trying.
Yes.
Victor French is in it, and, by the time he's done, there's not a piece of scenery left standing within a 200-mile radius. The man must have been really hungry before he came to work.
I wish, maybe not Sergio Carbucci or, maybe Burt Kennedy or somebody else who would have done Western, maybe more Westerns.
Yeah, because it's also around the time that, James Garner was doing those delightful
spoofs.
That's
true. Yep.
Support your local gunfighter, support your local sheriff, that were still hilarious. Yeah.
Scalp hunters, so all of them. Yeah. So almost. Next.
The Trouble with Girls.
Odd one. And it's
really
different.
Strange.
And it's set in a Chautauqua. And Elvis is the head of the Chautauqua. I believe he only has one number, clean up your own backyard. But there's a couple of
They do. He sings in the sort of gospel thing, too. Sweet Chariot
That. That's true. But there's, Vincent Price has a cameo. And there's a young Dabney Coleman. And there's kids. And, I mean, it's this kind
Sherry North.
Sherry North, that's right. But there's this almost ensemble piece, but it doesn't really connect as an ensemble for the most part.
Marilyn Mason is the and again, there's an attempt to sort of mature it. I mean, at one point, they're having a discussion where there's a sense of reproachment, and he's rubbing her shoulders and suggests maybe we should continue this conversation, somewhere else.
With a block of wood.
Yeah. Or not.
Or not.
Yeah. But again, it's like all the detail. They make some attempts to make it a 1920s period piece and all of that. And yet he shows up in a cream white suit with flaring, flaring pant legs.
Shellacked hair.
Well, shellacked hair and, and the return of the mutton chops. Sideburns and all of that. And, it's like, again, if you're going to do it, commit to it.
There's a great that same year in the commentary track for True Grit.
Yeah.
There's a film historian and the Western historian. And I always remember on Glenn Campbell's first entrance, you hear the Western historian go, yeah, that's a Western haircut.
Yeah.
It's just. Ugh.
Well, and what I hope we're going to talk about Might Have Been's, because apparently that was the Glenn Campbell part was one that Elvis was considered for.
Man, that's a good what could have.
Yeah. So
we'll get to those.
Yeah.
Next.
Change of habit.
All right. This is currently my daughter's favorite. Mm-hmm. It is Mary Tyler Moore as everyone's favorite undercover nun. So
Barbara McNair.
Barbara McNair as well. But it's Universal's attempt to look at a serious look at the counterculture. You have Ed Asner as a racist sheriff, racist police
officer.
Well,
actually, no. He's understanding. It's the man, the banker, who is the evil guy.
This
there.
Is why John is here, folks.
Yeah.
Shot on the Universal lot. Everyone's favorite ghetto doctor, Dr. John Carpenter, who, of course, directed Elvis, the miniseries with Kurt Russell.
Yeah, he's an incredibly expensively dressed ghetto doctor, too, which, just adds to the ambiance of the experience.
My daughter and I, our favorite moment, and this is, we dedicate this to Jenny McCarthy, is the little girl who has autism, and Elvis is going to hold her and hold her and love her until all the autism is run out of her.
Yes, it is. That scene is both painful and hypnotic to watch.
It goes on.
It's pretty much a masochist dream, I think. It's
like Costner at the end of Tin Cup.
It's really, really, but again, there are moments there.
I love the title track.
I do too.
Let Us Pray is not a bad way to end a film.
But again, and this is one of those things, it falls into the John Lennon category of, we're bigger than Jesus kind of thing. Because if you watch that, and again, spoiler alert for a movie that's almost 50 years old here, at the end of the movie, Mary Tyler Moore has returned to the convent. But she is really, really troubled because she has developed feelings for Elvis's character. And
the ultimate love triangle.
The mother superior says, "You're never going to be clear in your heart unless you meet with this man again and come." And so she goes to see Elvis performing, sort of a rock mass at the Catholic church. And the whole thing is set in New York, by the way. And the final scene, I kid you not, is Mary Tyler Moore, torn. She's looking at Elvis singing Let Us Pray, and then they cut to images of Jesus, Elvis, Jesus, Elvis, Jesus. And, at the end of the day, that's it. It's like the level of comparison. Yep. I suspect the only reason that did not become a source of controversy at the time is very few people saw it.
Yeah.
So, in part because of what was going on with his career, outside of the movies, he was doing much more interesting stuff.
Yeah, and Easy Rider was in theaters, and this.
Oh, yeah.
This was the Universal trying to do the counterculture. There's two guys who are so not the Black Panthers, and there's almost a riot on the Universal lot.
The
Puerto Rican the rapist guy who goes after Mary Tyler Moore.
The African American actors there were like right out of Hollywood Shuffle.
Correct.
Yeah, it was.
it's rough, but
yeah,
pretty good couple songs, yeah. Like Mary Tyler Moore and the weird love triangle.
Mary Tyler Moore and Elvis actually had quite a bit of chemistry, yep. I thought. That worked, and the scenes with Ed Asner just popped. I mean, you could see, and apparently that's how he came to be cast on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, because they filmed that right before they started production on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you can thank your Saturday night CBS Fest, a part of it, because of Change of Habit.
That's it.
Now, McKenna, I know there's two that are not on there because they are documentaries, but the following year we had, from 1970, Elvis, That's the Way It Is, which there are two. There is the regular theatrical version, and then when it came out on DVD, there was a director's cut. And it's about Elvis rehearsing with his band, well, with his band and the orchestra, his Vegas residency at the International. So he'd already done the 68 special. He had already started doing Vegas shows, if I remember correctly,
he'd started in 69, okay. And then he came back in February of 70, and I think they filmed in the summer of 70.
So we see the rehearsal process, which I don't think had been captured in a music documentary at this time. So when my daughter, at the height of her Hannah Montana phase, this was very enlightening for her because, well, let's face, if you see shows, especially sitcoms about rock bands, you don't see a whole lot of rehearsal. You see the aftermath of the rehearsal.
Yeah.
And the fact is, you know, the first half of the film is working on these songs, you know, bantering amongst one another. In the director's cut, they take out kind of the infomercial for the hotel.
Yeah.
And then the second half is the performance, which 1970 Elvis with the jumpsuit, with the covers, still pretty fun.
Oh,
to watch.
Yeah. Well, and some of it is, you could tell. I mean, he did look like a man who had been released at that point. And even the covers were great. I mean, the versions that he did of Creedence Clearwater's Proud Mary,
You Gave Me a Mountain.
Really powerful. That comes a little later, but, are just really, and you can tell, again, there's this reverence for what came before, and the versions, but he makes them into something else. The showstopper for that film, for that stand in Vegas, was his cover of the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Love and Feeling.
Yep.
And that's a really powerful moment. And whichever version of the documentary you see. But it bears little resemblance to the one that Bobby Hatfield and Bill Medley did.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, theirs was kind of a call and response thing. A classic soul thing, and his is just something else altogether.
Correct. And I think it always reminds me of when you see stand-up comics make the transition from film, and we talk Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, anybody else with that most of the time you would only get, sadly, maybe 10 or 20% of what they're actually capable of. And that's kind of like this, watching this film, is that after a decade of, hits and misses and near hits and everything, that he finally gets back to what he wants to do and lets loose.
Yeah.
No matter what the song choices were, and it was just fun to watch.
Well, and most of at that point the song choices, because he was still riding high. I mean, he'd done the 68 comeback special, which we've talked about, and then he went into American Studios and worked with Chips Moman, and probably came up with the single best album he ever did from Elvis in Memphis, and then they had enough cuts left over for another great album called Back in Memphis.
Yep.
But again, you get into the whole marketing strategy thing. They've got this superb studio album, and left the second part of the Memphis sessions, and his Vegas opening in 69, that I gather, he was completely wild and uninhibited. He was all over the stage and all of that. And the Colonel figures, okay, maybe we could milk these both. And he releases them as a completely incoherent double album. You've got the live show completely truncated, a lot of the songs taken out. And then Back in Memphis as sort of the second thing, but there's no thematic coherence or anything like that. nothing about what he might have been trying to do there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
This also led to 200 to 250 shows a year.
Oh, yeah. And which ultimately, you know,
killed him.
Killed him, yeah. And all of that, because the performances, you can tell That's the way it is. He's still really alive and in tune. The recording sessions are still really, really strong, even though, once again, he has tremendous success with Chips Moman. And, of course, the Colonel's answer is, let's not have him work with Chips Moman ever again.
And finally, in the filmography section, 1972's Elvis on Tour, a cinematic postcard, souvenir, I guess, of what Elvis was doing in the early 70s on the road.
It is. Well, you can see also kind of the disintegration, what was happening to him. Because there's a reference at the beginning that says that, the 1972 presidential primaries are going on. The comic makes that, which means then that it's being shot maybe a year and a half, not quite a year and a half, after That's the Way It Is. But he looks at least 5 or 6 years older at that point. And
it's also Count the Jumpsuits.
Yeah, and you can count, you can see the fatigue and so, and, you know, even if the arrangements are much stepped up and much more hurried of some of the old hits in That's the Way It Is, at least he's delivering them with conviction. And you can tell, by this point, because he's been on the road for so long, it's like, okay, I'm going to get through Don't Be Cruel for, the 556th time I've sung it in the past 6 months, so I can get to this new song that I really want to do.
Yep. And it was Martin Scorsese was one of the montage editors on this film.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And documentary nomination, if I remember
correctly. Yeah, it was. And it is a revealing slice. I mean, there are moving moments, like, they capture him retreating upstairs and just singing gospel.
Yep.
And, again, you can just see the kind of release for the guy that he's out from under it for a little while.
Yep. So that's the film, that's the Elvis filmography, and you alluded to one. I guess the bigger What Could Have Been, you mentioned True Grit. What about A Star Is Born?
Yeah, well, that's the big one, because that would have come near the end of his life.
Yep.
And at least the story is that Barbara Streisand and her then domestic partner John Peters came to see him, and Elvis and one of his buddies, Jerry Schelling, stepped into a closet in his dressing room so that everybody else would. And they pitched the story to him. He got really, really excited about it and wanted to do it. The Colonel saw that as a threat. To be fair, there probably were some doubts about whether Elvis and Barbara Streisand could have worked together effectively.
We heard you breathe, McKenna.
Yeah. Yeah. On the other hand, for those who are not familiar with the story, it is about a huge star who becomes involved with a younger woman who then begins her rise to become a star as his is falling. And it's sort of a doomed love story. Elvis would have been the older star whose star would have been. He was not the star whose star was going to be born as part.
No, that is correct. So he would.
And one of the problems with the Streisand version of the film, it had been done a couple of times before. Yeah. I always thought was, I just never believed that Kris Kristofferson was on his way down.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean it would have been interesting to see if Elvis could have pulled that off at that stage of, and would have been willing to expose, because apparently he had very, very real fears at that time that the music world, the entertainment world, were leaving him behind.
Weren't there stories like by 1974, this is after the Aloha, the Hawaii broadcast, that when the weight started to show that he there were some shows he didn't want to be photographed. Is that right?
Yeah, I heard that. Although it's interesting, and it shows that sort of cliche in our business that how much weight the camera adds.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go to Graceland, and yes, I have been to Graceland, and they have a lot of, you know, the outfits, the jumpsuits, the stage yeah. outfits he wore. And one of the things that is shocking is you get to the stuff like the famous Gold Sun, the one that he wore here in Indianapolis for the last show. When we think that he, you know, was just almost, you know, morbidly obese or whatever, and look at that, and I'd say 90% of American men, there's no way they could slide into that thing. And, you know, which makes you realize, A, in the days, you know, like for the 68 TV special, when, you know, all leather, and he's so thin that he had cheekbones you could shave with, you know, and all of that, that he must have just been a toothpick at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I, you know, we that was before the famous food story started to bubble up to the surface.
Well, the fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches, and you realize, you know, I think someone did that and calculated the calories in just one of those.
Oh, God.
And each one of them was like 1,600 calories. So you realize, you know, two of those and you're...
you're a nap.
Yeah, yeah.
So you and you mentioned True Grit. Were there other offers that
well,
you were, that
you know,
remember
I think there were whispers that... At one point, they were kind of looking at him for the John Voight part, Midnight Cowboy, which would have been really interesting. Now, whether, you know, as a good Southern boy from a religious background, he could have played a gay hustler, you know, is an interesting question. And in one of its many iterations, his name was associated with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I don't think seriously. It's sort of like, yeah, because
Burt Reynolds that, being considered for James Bond.
Yeah, they you know, that that screenplay bounced around and the concept bounced around for so long that there was that. But you know, I mean, at one point he was also being considered for West Side Story, which might have been an interesting choice too, and certainly forced him to think more seriously about what he was doing on film.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's the entire filmography. McKenna, you've been scribbling notes furiously on where to start, where not to start. So they're all available. Go take a look. But yeah, there's some fun stuff, and there's some bad stuff, and there's some good, and there's some bad, and there's some ugly.
Yeah.
You just have to figure that out, I think, for yourselves.
And if you want to, just go out there and reconstruct Hale's top 40 for yourself.
We're getting you back on the show for that.
All right.
John, thank you so much.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen, in its entirety, for the first time, my chat with John Krull, host of No Limits, talking about the movies of Elvis Presley. Where else here but Film Sociology and WFYI? John, thank you for all your radio service here. Glad to call you a colleague and a friend. He's not dead. It's just new show coming along. So anyway, that being said, we're going to wrap things up with a little tribute. There's one more dead person we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. Actor Rip Torn passed away. My gosh, where to start? Do you know him from Larry Sanders? Do you know him from Sweet Bird of Youth? Do you know him from Not Getting Easy Rider? Film credits go all the way back to the 50s. Baby Doll, Pork Chop Hill, King of Kings, where he played Judas, Sweet Bird of Youth, the original 60 version and the 80s version, Critics' Choice, a lot of TV, Cincinnati Kid, Beach Red, Beyond the Law, Tropic of Cancer. Yes, he was the villain in Slaughter. Look up how, mentioning Easy Rider, the things that happened with that. The underrated film Payday, Cotter, Crazy Joe, Nasty Habits, Coma,
One Trick Pony, Heartland. And I always tell the story, Heartland's an underrated drama with Rip Torn and Conchata Farrell. She is a mail-order bride sent out to live in the Heartland, the title, with Rip Torn, who's the farmer. And you get to see the two of those great actors help birth a calf. They don't teach that in acting school. Seduction of Joe Tynan, One Trick Pony, First Family, Stranger is Watching, The Beastmaster. I saw that in the theater. Jinxed, Airplane 2, his only Oscar nomination, Best Supporting Actor for Cross Creek, Misunderstood, Flashpoint, Songwriter, Primo Pitt in City Heat, yeah, Summer Rental with John Candy, Extreme Prejudice, Nadine, Cold Feet, Beautiful Dreamers, Dolly Dearest, and by the time we get into the 90s, a lot of stuff I haven't even seen, but he was still working, bouncing back and forth. He was a Columbo killer in the early 90s, the CEO in RoboCop 3, How to Make an American Quilt. For the younger generation, younger than me, the voice of Zeus in Hercules and Zed, of course, in the Men in Black series. The Outsider, Wonder Boys. Just a guy constantly working. So thank you, Rip Torn. And with that in mind, a special Words to Live By.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
What? Oh! Oh! Oh!
Thanks, Rip. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Don't forget, I'll be at the midnight screening of The Room this Friday and Saturday night at midnight at Keystone Arts. Hope to see you there. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!